This broadcast of OPF Radio on May 30th of 2013 is about Verbicide. Gary Hunt is the guest, and your host is Sleepy Salsa. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are listening to Outpost of Freedom Radio. Words are very important for the conveyance of concepts. The founders were meticulous in their expression of concepts. Many words, however, have had their meanings changed by the educational process and other societal methods, the effect being that we have lost some of what we were as Americans. Does there exist today a form of genocide to the very concept of liberty itself through the use of words to effect change by means of covert subversion of intent? With that said, let us turn to our guest. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Sleepy. How are you this evening?
I'm doing quite well, quite well. Well, let's go ahead and get started then. What exactly is Verbicide?
Well, Verbicide is probably best defined as the use of changing the definition of a word to have the effect of social engineering, changing the way we think, changing, say, the force of law. It's destructive, social engineering, and it's destructive of the way of life that was fought for 230 years ago.
All right, well then, what's the deal here? I mean, is Verbicide bad or what?
Well, if by manipulation of language, by coercive means, by public education, by any other means, you can change society's way of looking at something, and that new way of looking at it is restrictive of our freedom, of our liberty, then obviously it's bad, and it's reality, and so we've got something happening in our society. It's been going on for decades, going on in our society, where we are willingly acquiescing to the loss of freedoms or change in nature of the relationship of government to people or any number of areas.
All right, so how does one determine whether a word suffers from Verbicide?
Well, words have meanings, and you know, I've defined it this way before to people. Communication, verbal communication, in a sense, is a game, and it has rules to the game. And those rules are the definition of the words. An example I use quite often is many years ago, this is back in the 60s, I was in a conversation with some guys in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we were talking about water. And the guy said, well, when I say water, I mean only potable water. I'm not counting the ocean. And I said, well, I can't discuss it with you then because most of the water in the world is salty and sits in the ocean. That's just a very simple explanation. But if I can't use the term water to mean that stuff in the ocean, what do I call it? Sand? We've got sand on the beach, and then we've got sand in the ocean. You know, we can't change the rules to accommodate somebody's presentation of something. That's what adjectives and adverbs are for. They're to define, further define something. Civil rights versus rights is a good example. Now, civil is from Roman civil law, and it's where the emperor and the Senate are supreme, and they can make law whatever they want. That's civil law. And so if it's civil rights, they are granted by government. Now, the Constitution didn't say that government is giving you the right to freedom of speech or freedom of the press or any of the other freedoms. It's implied in the document that these are natural rights that come from God. And if they're natural rights that come from God, they obviously the government can't take them away, or that was the concept 200 years ago. However, if they're civil rights, everybody has a right to a television, everybody has a right to have a steak every Friday night for dinner, those are civil rights. Everybody's got a right to color television. Those are civil rights that are granted by government, and anything granted by government, quite obviously, can be taken away by government. So we have to look at the words. Now, to determine if a word suffers from verbicide, you have to look at the original definition. You have to go back 230 years. And so I frequently refer to Webster's 1828 dictionary to see what something means. And when I understand what it meant to the era of the founding fathers, then I have a better idea of what they intended when they wrote something back then. If we take what they teach us in public school, all rights are civil rights. There's no distinction between them. And so determination of whether word suffers from verbicide, quite simply, look at the past and think, has the word changed its meaning? If it's changed its meaning, why did it change its meaning? Was it to deprive us or deny us something?
Okay, well then, why would anyone want to commit verbicide in the first place?
Well, I would think, I would say that the most, at least in my observation of it, the most pronounced effect is, as I said, social engineering. It's a way to get us to accept a premise that we shouldn't accept, or not accept a premise that we should accept, and give government greater control, allow them to become more despotic or tyrannical in their application, and have us accept that because the word has changed meaning, and now we have to accept the new definition, which is restrictive instead of permissive.
So on that note, then, is verbicide part of political correctness?
Well, it without a doubt, the whole concept of political correctness is you can't say this. You have to say that. How could political correctness, saying the right thing, be accomplished unless verbicide was a factor in that? Political correctness is a little broader than that, because sometimes it's just outright prohibitive. But to achieve the end of political correctness, we're going to discuss some words in a little while, and I think that'll be demonstrated as we go into those words, so we'll pass that on a little bit, but there's no doubt that political correctness is an aspect of verbicide.
All right, well then, I think what you're kind of suggesting then possibly is, well, let me phrase it this way. Does verbicide alter the way we think?
Surprisingly, absolutely. And again, we will discuss one word in particular in a while that will demonstrate and convince people that, yes, it definitely changes the way we think. It puts a block against using a word. Therefore, that since I can't use that word, my mind doesn't – it skips over that word. If I'm going to write something and I'm going to use that word and I say, no, I can't use that word, then I can't use that word. And after a while, my mind doesn't even consider that word anymore. It's out of my vocabulary.
Well, earlier you mentioned about social engineering. So, Gary, would it be accurate to say that verbicide is a major element of social engineering?
Again, without a doubt. Without verbicide, it would be very difficult. A lot of the aspects of social engineering would be impossible.
Okay,
If those words had the meaning they had 230 years ago, it would be impossible to infringe upon them. There's a word right there, darn. Infringe upon them. That means don't even ruffle the edges of this. It's the strongest, one of the strongest words in the Constitution. It shall not be infringed, the right to keep and bear arms.
Yeah, I remember seeing a sign one time that said, what part of shall not be infringed do you not understand?
That's exactly it. And if we went to Webster's 1828 and looked up at infringe, we would, you don't even ruffle the edges of it. So I'm not sure exactly what the wording is, but that's an example. And so, yes, it's a major element because that's the one that allows our mind, by accepting new definitions of words and rejecting the use of other words, manages to achieve social engineering. And let's go back to a phrase we used earlier, civil rights. What was the 1960s? Civil rights era. Ah, civil rights era. Okay, so the government. And I'm gonna go into a bit of a demonstration of something right now. No, we'll wait until we discuss one of the words that I want to discuss tonight is progress. So we'll wait until we get there before we go to.
Sure. Well, you mentioned Webster's 1828 a moment ago. Let me just go into that just a little bit. What role do dictionaries play in verbicide?
They have become tools of social engineering. They attribute it to common usage. But that common usage quite often is a consequence of political correctness. So whether they're cooperative dupes or not, when they rewrite dictionaries, which used to be infrequently, because they're rules of the game, and if they are constantly changing, how do we know what we're talking about? So, yes, they are, whether it's a voluntary contribution to that, or not, you know, I can't really say. I don't know who writes the dictionaries now. I do know that they come out a lot more frequently than they used to. They used to come out every 5 to 10 years, and they'd usually add words. But there weren't that many changes in definition. And in fact, you know, I think back to my school days, and I don't think that words, you know, if I looked in one dictionary and another, I found two of the same, say Webster's Collegiate. Not much change, maybe a few new words added, you know, when we entered the atomic age and isolated, the tables, you know, the elements, that's it. Words had to be added when they invented airplanes. Hey, radio, they had to add that. Television, they had to have that. So it was an expansion of what was. Back then, but I look in dictionaries now, and I don't even like having a new dictionary around because it confuses the hell out of me, and it's not because I'm getting old and my mind doesn't work, because I can look back in an older dictionary and see that I was right, so I can verify my position, but I look in a new dictionary, and I'm astounded sometimes at what a word means.
Yeah, I always thought that the sign of a developing civilization was an expanding dictionary, not a shrinking one. Well, okay, well, here's, I guess, maybe the $64,000 question then before we get into the examples of verbicide is, why is verbicide an ailment that threatens to destroy our freedom and liberty?
Let's see. Let me rephrase that. Why is verbicide an ailment that has destroyed our freedom and liberty? Let's make it a matter of fact. It's not don't tread on me as you have tread on me. Perhaps the civil rights of the 60s is one way of demonstrating it, that the world changed drastically to the point that, without saying it, we know that hate crimes are only white on black, not black on white, white on Hispanic, not Hispanic on white. So, if we all have the same freedom and same liberty, how come we've got a set of laws that's preferential to those that aren't even part of the original development of this country? Now, there's a series of articles I wrote called We the People, which will explain that for those that have any doubts as to what I mean by the people that originated this country. But they're the ones at the bottom of the stack now, and their liberties and freedoms have been curtailed drastically in order to provide for another class of people. Now, this is true in many areas, and I'm just using civil rights to demonstrate one that has made it, well, like in England, where you can't hit a Muslim, but a Muslim can hit you.
Yeah, yeah, your series entitled We the People, But Who Are We was very eye-opening. Well, let's go ahead and just look at kind of the meat of the matter in one sense. So, Gary, what are some of the most common examples of verbicide?
Well, let's start with a simple one. It's called marriage. I think we delegated you the responsibility to look up and read Webster's 1828 with regard to certain words, and so I'll let you read the definition from 1828, almost 200 years ago.
All righty. The Webster's 1828 definition of marriage is thusly, the act of uniting a man and woman for life, wedlock, the legal union of a man and woman for life. Marriage is a contract, both civil and religious, by which the parties engage to live together in mutual affection and fidelity till death shall separate them. Marriage was instituted by God himself for the purpose of preventing the promiscuous intercourse of the sexes, for promoting domestic felicity, and for securing the maintenance and education of children.
Okay, now I'm going to go to Black's Law Dictionary right now and read what a marriage license is. Now, this is marriage is between. I'm going to go to U.S. Code first. This is your current U.S. Code, 1 U.S. Code, Section 7, Definition of Marriage and Spouse. In determining the meaning of any act of Congress or of any ruling, regulation, or interpretation of the various administrative bureaus and agencies of the United States, the word marriage means only a legal union between one man and one woman as husband and wife, and the word spouse refers only to the person of the opposite sex who is a husband or a wife. Now, marriage licenses began, I guess they go back in English history. Sometimes you had to have permission. Some people had to have permission to marry. Others didn't. New Jersey was one of the colonies that required it. But marriage license was to this is Black's Law Dictionary, 5th edition. A license or permission granted by public authority to persons who intend to intermarry, usually addressed to the minister or magistrate who is to perform the ceremony, or in general terms, to anyone authorized to solemnize marriages. By statutes in most jurisdictions, it is made an essential prerequisite to the lawful solemnization of the marriage. So, the lawful solemnization of a marriage, true, but this intermarry part, what does intermarry mean? Well, there's a word called miscegenation. That means mixing of the races. And so it became more commonly used, still a man and a woman, when people wanted to intermarry, create mulattoes, for example, as offsprings. Now, what does marriage come to mean today? And I'm sure by now we've got dictionaries that say a marriage is, a solemnization of a relationship between any two people. So, something that's existed for thousands of years, the concept of marriage, has been turned over in the last couple decades into a new meaning. So when you talk marriage now, again, the mind begins to think, well, that includes any two people. We've begun to exclude from our mental thought process that it's a man and a woman. Now, I don't speak for all of us. I'm sure there are some that are astute as I am and have problems with this whole idea of queer marriages, but that's an example. That's verbicide. Marriage now means any two people who cannot procreate. Their purpose is not to bear children, perhaps to raise them in their own lifestyle, but not to bear children.
Well, what about the actual licensure issue? I mean, the actual licensing of marriage as opposed to just registering marriages. Do you think that would probably play a role in the actual verbicide of the word marriage itself, taking it from what it was before, where it was just registering you know, that, you know, John Doe and Jane Doe were married, et cetera, as opposed to this licensure where people where John and Jane are now asking the government, please, you know, be a third party to our marriage.
Well, if we go back to England and the earlier colonial periods, you have to understand that there were no citizens then. They were all subjects. Everybody belonged to the crown. If they were referred to as citizen, it was in a whole different context than was established with the creation of the United States and perhaps in some other countries as well, but primarily the United States. So that permission, that license, might have meaning in permission of the king through his agents to allow marriage. And I think, as near as I can tell, that's the way it was in New Jersey, where I'm vaguely familiar with the fact that they had to both announce their marriage, which means that other people could come and contest it for any reason. Oh, she's had a child by me, or something, and then they could get married, and then the license was issued. But then my first wife's parents have on their wall a certificate of marriage. They don't have a marriage license. They have a certificate of marriage. That was signed by the minister who solemnized their marriage. And that's on their wall, or was. They're gone now. But the idea of licensure really hit a heyday back in the 1930s, when there was perhaps late 20s, when there was a lot of syphilis going around the country, indiscriminate sex, syphilis, the Tuskegee experiments with injecting people with syphilis and watching the growth patterns of it and seeing what would work and what not. And it was kind of interesting, because when this proliferation of the use, the initiation of laws requiring a marriage license also required a blood test. And the blood test was to see if one or the other party had syphilis. If they did, then the other party, the spouse, would be told that, hey, he's got syphilis, you know. I don't know if they didn't allow the marriage, or they just advised that person that the other person has syphilis, you know, take your own chances. I don't know how they applied it, quite frankly. However, I do know that now they still have blood tests, but if one of the parties has AIDS, the government can't tell the other party that the other party has AIDS. So that's gone full circle. So was this whole thing just a slow procedure in establishing a control over our lives? Now, and I don't have the case in front of me, but I remember reading it years ago. It was from Arizona. It was 1925, if I remember correctly. And apparently they had marriage licenses then, in Arizona, because I don't know if the civil marriage and the religious marriage, if they both occurred. Some people might have gone to the JP, maybe some just to the church, so maybe some got licensed. Maybe there was miscegenation in this marriage. But what the decision said, and it was rather interesting, it says that the marriage was a contract between three parties. And since two of them can't disagree in treating the offspring or the byproduct of that marriage, meaning the child, then the third party, the state, shall decide what's going to happen with the child. Well, that's legal precedence. You know, that the state becomes a party. If you get married by a license with permission of the state, all three of you got married. You just didn't know you were married to the state. And if you and your wife can't get along, then the third party comes in and would theoretically make a majority by taking one side or the other, but then that's expanded to where they don't necessarily come in agreement with the wife or the husband, but they'll come in with a third position, and they're stronger than the other two, so they'll give the child to somebody else. So here's an example of verbicide and the concept of marriage that exists for thousands of years, being used to give power to the state over the family, over the byproduct of a marriage, the children of this country.
Yeah, and I honestly don't understand why some individuals think that it is progress or progressive or whatever word they're using now, that it's somehow a sign of progress to have marriage go from basically a private contract that was registered to now being licensed under the state, you know, with the state. I don't understand how that's a good thing.
Well, I study my genealogy and I go back and I find that there are public records showing a marriage, and they show the minister that performed the deed, and that there are church records where the minister records all the marriages and all the births and baptisms and things like that. So at least in some states back in the early, the colonial and the early constitutional periods in this country, the recording was there. Now, that's beneficial because if you want to track your ancestry, there's records, written records. But look what it's come to now. People fear the birth certificate. They say it's a bond or chattel. It creates chattel out of the byproduct of it. There may be some truth to that. I don't think it's true, though, to the extent that they say. I think it's more in keeping a continual census going, births and deaths and recordings. But the idea of recording is one thing, and the idea of licensing, license by definition, what do you have the definition of license handy?
Not right at this moment.
Well, let me paraphrase it. License is permission given by the government to do what would otherwise be illegal.
God, getting married would otherwise be illegal without permission. Good Lord, what have we come to?
Well, just think about it then. What happens? I guess we're all byproducts of illegal relationships through the history of our country, because people out in the prairie had no government to marry them. They might have had a pastor. They might have just lived in sin or declared themselves married.
But wouldn't that be referred to as a common law marriage now?
It probably would be. Well, common law marriage varied from state to state. I know that my uncle was married by common law, and then they solemnized the marriage, and 2 weeks later she left with the truck driver. But common law marriage used to be a right. And yes, the assumption that you were married and living together openly and notoriously, presenting yourself as husband and wife for a period of time, would give rights to the other spouse. So if I died, my wife, by common law marriage, would have all the rights of somebody that was married. But see, the government's come into play in this, and now if you're not married, the attorneys get involved, and when about 99% of the estate is gone, they finally settle and give the remaining 1% to the other spouse. Wow. So it's come into the hands of the government, and it's come into the hands of the government in the form that's created by those that write the laws, which tend to be the lawyers who tend to get the 99% and leave the residual, the whole 1%, to the other spouse. But yes, that's verbicide, isn't it? Because we've changed the nature of something that stood for thousands of years, whether there was a license required or not, whether the government was party to it or not, is inconsequential. Marriage meant one thing. And the idea, and I sometimes get in a discussion and the guy says, well, my wife and I are can't procreate, so we must not be married. No, it doesn't mean that. But the purpose is procreation. If you can't for one reason or another, then that doesn't mean it's not a marriage if it's a man and a woman. But the idea of procreation and the monogamy, the one man, one woman, and for life that you read from Webster's, that was the concept. So by what right does this government now begin to change definitions? They're pretty crafty, because the Supreme Court, the supreme law of the land, the laws made in accordance with the Constitution, 1 U.S. Code, Section 7, I mean, they didn't put this definition in there because they didn't have the authority to. They say that the federal government, any act of Congress or any ruling, regulation, or interpretation of the various administrative bureaus and agencies of the United States, the word marriage means. But then we've got justices in the Supreme Court and the state Supreme Court saying, well, that's unconstitutional. What changed here, the Constitution or the definition of marriage?
Well, what I can say as far as the effects of verbicide, at least with the word marriage, was there's actually a good friend of mine from my college days, and I this was a kind of a sticky point in one of our many lengthy conversations, and I tried to kind of appeal to her with, you know, the notion of like a common law marriage, or, you know, the marriages that, you know, where you just register and you get licensed, and like what the founders did and the people at that time and since then, of course, for a while after. And unfortunately, she still thought, you know, if there's not that piece of paper, the license, it's not a real marriage. That was her attitude.
Well, that was, and the unfortunately, she was the project.
Yeah, and she was the product of a, you know, public school education too. I mean, there's that aspect of that as well. But that's kind of what, I mean, that was somebody of my generation thinks that if you don't have a license at marriage, then it's not a real marriage. Even though I explained all, you know, what happened before, it didn't matter. I mean, that's how complete it's been.
Well, it has been, and, you know, schools are definitely a part of that, government schools, and, you know, the worst thing, well, our last program, public education, the schools have become the sources of establishing a foundation in the minds of our children, which is why my two girls are homeschooled. But let's look at back in the 1930s. There was a guy named Hitler, and he wanted the children to belong to the state. And at a certain age, they went into the kinder corps, or whatever it was called.
Hitler Youth.
Well, yeah, the various different ones. Even in the lower grades, they were in schools. And these schools were teaching the absolute values. And there was no, anybody who challenged those values was subject to imprisonment or death or both. He also, in propagating the species, had women whose only job was to match with, mate with the pure Aryans in the military, and those children, I don't recall the, what they're called, but there are some of them still alive. They were byproducts of a child production factory established by Hitler. If we control the youth, we control the future.
Yeah, I remember the Third Reich would give medals to German mothers who produced an X number of X number of children.
The opposite of the Chinese, huh?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it wasn't exactly back on the one-child policy, but definitely totalitarian in. But both were totalitarian in intention. You know, the self-determination of the individual be damned.
Well, in both cases, the government decided that they wanted to be a player in the role of child rearing, didn't they?
Yeah, it's complete control freak behavior. But what can you expect from a bunch of tyrants?
So that's the social engineering that's occurred as a consequence of the redefinition of the word marriage. Yeah. Partially, I mean, there's other aspects to it, but marriage by the redefinition puts everybody, you know, if two lesbian women had a child, which is impossible, but if they adopted a child, you know, that child then is the product of that marriage, therefore it belongs to the state, so that child has come into the ownership of the state, if it wasn't already, you know, if they went to China and got the kid and brought it here. But I imagine there's something in that contract that makes the government a party too. So the government's a party to a third party in the relationship of almost all the children in this country. Now, I'm married by common law, if you want to call it that. So the government's not a party, and they've never tried to intervene in the two daughters I'm raising now. They did intervene at one point with one of my children, and had a long conversation with the Child Protective Services, and they promised never to come to our house again. That's another story.
Good. Well, it was also interesting in the definition of marriage, too, that other sense about marriage was instituted by God himself for the purpose of, and it goes on the list. And I find it interesting that Webster's 1828 dictionary, there was nothing at all about government giving licensure. All it mentioned was, you know, marriage is a contract, and it was instituted by God himself, and that was it.
Let's look at another aspect of marriage, too. Churches now, to retain their 501c3 status, have to be very careful what they say. Now, churches were the source of marriage for centuries. But all of a sudden, the churches cannot speak out against queer marriages, or they lose their tax-free status.
I was just thinking that. You think this might have something to do with that 501c3 status?
Absolutely. That's why very few churches aren't speaking out, and the ones that do probably aren't 501c3s. But that's where our mind does not allow us to perceive what should be perceived. Instead, we can perceive only what has to be. And this ministers in church, they're supposed to be obedient to God after their obedience to the government, I guess, because it's very important that they retain that 501(c) status.
So what is that, the new theology of civil submission to government?
Well, let's call it civil religion, shall we?
Yeah, but the ironic part, Gary, is that if for some reason I don't want, my tax monies to go to some sort of irresponsible baby mama whose children are being subsidized by the government, I'm supposedly not charitable. I mean, I've heard that rhetoric for years.
Well, yeah. Speaking of charitable, let's go on to the next word.
Well, Webster's 1828 dictionary defines charity thusly: in a general sense, love, benevolence, goodwill, that disposition of heart which inclines men to think favorably of their fellow men and to do them good. In a theological sense, it includes supreme love to God and universal goodwill to men.
Well, that's kind of interesting. So let's look at charity. Charity was very common in this country throughout its history, whether it was the old common schools, whether it was the sanitation commission that took care of soldiers during the Civil War. Charity has been fundamental to the growth of this country. Charity, let's see. You've got a child or a nephew or something, and you want to get him a birthday or a Christmas present, so you get him a present that I want something that'll really please him. And so then when he tears the ribbon off and tears the wrapping off and opens it, and his eyes open wide, and he's extremely pleased. He just loves you for getting this G.I. Joe. I'm going to be politically incorrect on this. G.I. Joe set. He's just ecstatic, and the feeling that you get inside of you when you see the pleasure on his face because you got a gift, that's charity. You gave him a gift, and you got to reap the reward of seeing the consequences, the value placed upon the gift you gave him. Let's look at charity in the old sense. During the 30s, when people were traveling across the country, a lot of towns said, don't stop here, there's no jobs. But a lot of people, I forgot how they marked their house. I think the tramps did it. But if a family that was poor in itself would not let somebody go hungry, would feed them, I think the tramps would mark a fence corner with a symbol. And people would stop there knowing that they would receive charity. They'd receive a meal. Perhaps they could get some clothes or something. But the people that did that did it because they were giving something and they were pleased at the reaction of their act of giving. I think the Bible says is better to give than to receive. I mean, that's the whole concept of charity. So what's happened to charity in this country? Well, most of the large charitable organizations, and I'll name two of them that I have had particular dealings with, the Salvation Army and the Red Cross, that's charity. No, I don't have to give anybody any money. That's charity. And I don't mean panhandling when I say charity, by the way. That's a lucrative profession for people in New York. The government's taking care of, or the agencies are taking care of charity, but the government's giving these agencies money. It's got contracts with them. In Waco, I called the Red Cross and said, are you going to try and get food and medical supplies to the Davidians? And they said, we can't. It's a crime scene. The government won't let us in. Oh, shit. Be obedient to the government, Red Cross. The director makes a couple $100,000 a year plus perks. And that comes out before the contributions. Another Red Cross event, when I was in basic training in the Army back in 1964, this guy's wife was having a baby, and it was due in 3 days. And so he went to the Red Cross, or 2 days, something like that, went to the Red Cross and said, my wife's going to have a baby. Can you give me an airplane ticket so I can go down and see her, be there when the child's born? No, but we'll give you a bus ticket. Oh, shit. He didn't get there in time. That was the Red Cross. These are good guys. They gave him a bus ticket, but he missed the birth because they wouldn't give him a plane ticket. The other one is the Salvation Army. Some of the Davidians, after they got out of jail, were allowed only to stay in the halfway house, which was run by the Salvation Army, which receives hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars a year, as does the Boy Scouts now, by the way, for doing various things for the government. So they run the halfway house. And so I had been going to visit Ruth Riddle, and all of a sudden I was told that I cannot go to the halfway house anymore to visit somebody. They're in a halfway house. They're supposed to begin interacting with people outside of jail because they were such bad people for living in that awful church out called Mount Carmel Center. But Red Cross enforced this stupid prohibition against me talking to these people. Anybody else was allowed in. So these people kowtow to the government. They're not going to provide food and medical supplies to people who are denied it by the government. They're not going to even try. They're going to call it a crime scene. They're not going to let people interface with those outside of jail unless those people meet a standard established by the government. This is where charity is funneled. United Fund. You give it to United Fund. You don't even know which charities it goes to. But charitable, now that means that charitable nowadays means I get a tax deduction. If I give $1,000 to charity, I've reduced my earned income by $1,000 and I don't have to pay tax on that $1,000. How wonderful.
Yeah, reducing the tax liability, yeah.
Right. So the charity, again, has gone from one thing, that God-given gift of appreciation of the reaction to the gift that you give in any form, to a tax benefit. Son of a gun. Let's put that under the heading of verbicide, shall we?
And that's stealing something away from us that is very human.
Right.
I mean, and that's not just limited to the various different, European heritages that, belong under Western civilization. I mean, that's kind of all around the world. You have different forms and flavors of charity, so it really is a human thing. And
well, let's go a little bit further. Let's call it what it is. It's dehumanizing. We're losing some of that humanity that God gave us when we were born.
Yeah.
Or if you don't believe in God, the feelings that you get, we're being dehumanized.
Yeah, that nature, right, that nature imparts into our very essence is being stripped from us. And it is dehumanizing, much like when TSA agents, maul old women and young women, children, and the rest of it under the guise of non-existent security theater. But in any case, yeah, it's completely dehumanizing. And it's very, again, I still think it's very totalitarian. Even authoritarian regimes usually allow their beleaguered subjects, their hapless citizens, at least a degree of liberty in one sense, so that they don't feel completely like animals. But totalitarian regimes, they don't even care even about that. I mean, we're scum to them, quite frankly. And well, by perverting what charity is.
There's a related word, so let's move on to that one.
Oh, yeah, welfare.
Okay, Black's Webster's 1828
defines welfare as exemption from misfortune, sickness, calamity, or evil, the enjoyment of health, and the common blessings of life, prosperity, happiness, applied to persons.
It doesn't say color television or free food or
nope.
Anything? Free rent? Free car? They're not. Oh, there weren't cars back then. There weren't televisions. I guess we can exclude those two.
Not even food stamps.
What it's saying is that you're free to go out and acquire these things. Is that what it's saying? How would you paraphrase it?
No, it's an exemption from misfortune, sickness, calamity, or evil. Meaning that you have a general, quality of life, I guess, to some degree, maybe, perhaps.
Right, and the government's going to do what it can to keep you from having misfortune in that area.
Mm.
Does that sound right to you?
I don't know. It almost sounds kind of vague in one other sense because it depends on one's interpretation, almost.
Well, does it sound like something's going to be given to you?
No. It sounds more like a definition of like a guardian. or what like a guardian would be doing.
So a comfortable environment to live your life in, maybe?
Oh, God. Actually, yeah, this is a tricky one, isn't it?
It is, and we've got to overcome that impression we've got of the word welfare to get there.
Well, unfortunately, I've known, you know, I know people even in college who, when I meant, you know, mentioned welfare, they think of, you know, people on food stamps.
Well, we talked about adjectives a little while ago. Let's look at an adjective. How about general? Would that mean everybody?
I guess that's one definition, perhaps.
Well, I mean, if I put general in front of welfare, what could I possibly mean by that? Do I mean that? Now, here is the implication that we're going to create an environment where you're not subject to these to the extent possible. You know, these you can acquire goods, you avoid crime, you know, that we're going to create a comfortable environment.
Right.
Okay, let's go to one more word. How about promote? Does that mean give? Or encourage?
Promote. I guess encourage. If someone's like promoting like a product or something, they're trying to encourage, you know, it's good qualities, I guess. If I had to kind of wing it here little bit.
Do you have Black's or Webster's in front of you? Let's look at promote.
Yeah. All right. Just give me just a moment. But yeah, I didn't quite think about that before. That's rather interesting. Okay, Webster's 1828 defines promote as to forward, to advance, to contribute to the growth, enlargement, or excellence of anything valuable, or to the increase of anything evil, as to promote learning, knowledge, virtue, or religion, to promote the interests of commerce or agriculture, to promote the arts, to promote civilization or refinement, to promote the propagation of the gospel, to promote vice and disorder. So again, to forward, to advance, to contribute to the growth, enlargement, or excellence of anything valuable, or to increase of anything evil. So it's more about a, seems to be more.
Encouragement. Yeah. Okay, so encouragement is a good synonym. How about general? Look up general.
Okay.
Not the military one, the other one.
Right, I thought about that, right. All right, Webster's 1828 defines general as properly relating to a whole genius or kind, and hence relating to a whole class or order. Thus, we
okay,
speak
so
of,
if we were giving it out, we would have to give a color television to everybody then, right? If it meant to provide rather than promote.
Logically it would have to be. In fact, now I didn't. Okay, I see what you're getting
We've
at.
We've gone with three words now, and those that haven't picked up on it yet. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. Darn. We just went through those three words. Now, you wondered how we determine if something's verbicide. If we look at the root definitions of those words, the original ones, time of the founders, they're to encourage for everybody an environment whereby they can achieve their goals in life.
Yeah, I have a weird feeling that the framers of the Constitution did not intend in the preamble that everybody should be basically getting, you know, free products and services at the expense of someone else.
Well, let's look. If they say provide, they would mean to give it to, right?
I would assume so, yes.
Okay, well, the phrase before that, provide for the common defense. Oh, the government had to put money out to support the Army, the Navy, and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, but it seems that somehow with the military and industrial complex, we're promoting the common defense and providing the general welfare. Or, no, specific welfare. So, verbicide, welfare. Welfare has been verbicided to a whole new meaning. And it came from people receiving benefits during the Depression or at any other time which usually had an obligation with them and quite often were provided by charitable organizations, to something that's a mandate on the state to provide for at least some people at the expense of others. That sounds more like communism than republicanism. I'm not sure. But see, we've been verbicided. Charity and general welfare, both of those words have been converted to a point that the government is taking your charitable contribution through their agencies or the government itself and using them to favor some at your expense, or if you're the beneficiary, to favor you at somebody else's expense. And they have become, in that sense, they have become an insurance company. What's happening up in Sandy, New Jersey? What's happening in Moore, Oklahoma? What happened in New Orleans? What happened in Miami? Is the government steps in as an insurance company. They're the good guys. If your house is torn down and you didn't have insurance, we will build you a new one. Maybe. If it gets too expensive, maybe we won't. We'll buy 10,000 trailers, but then we'll trash them because they have formaldehyde in them, as all trailers do. But the government has stolen from us the feeling that comes from giving.
Right.
They have converted charity into a tax benefit, and they have used that the money that you give them to provide the new version of welfare to specific people.
That's really vile.
So there's an effect of verbicide. Let's go on to the next one now. Did you have a comment on that? Go ahead.
Yeah, just very briefly, kind of like how I can confirm the verbicide of marriage with my example from earlier. Similarly, I can do that with welfare. There's an acquaintance of mine who is on food stamps, and there is a phrase that, you know, other people, you know, like him use and all that, which is, you know, I am on welfare. And that's about as proof positive as it comes. Like, if you say, oh, so-and-so is on welfare, what that really means is the getting food stamps and basically those things that the government puts out to people on the dole.
It's become his vocation.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Well, professional leech, I think, is more appropriate. But we'll call it vocation, but we wouldn't want to offend those people that are standing in line to get things for free.
Right. Touche. Well, this next one is definitely a doozy. The word public, and again, Webster's 1828 dictionary defines public as pertaining to a nation, state, or community, extending to a whole people as a public law, which binds the people of a nation or state as opposed to a private statute or resolve, which respects an individual or corporation only. Thus we say the public welfare, public good, public calamity, public service, public property, etc.
It doesn't say the government?
The government is not mentioned at any point. I will add the proviso, depending on what you mean by the word state, but otherwise, no, government is not mentioned.
Oh, so the public is us.
Yes.
The people
of a nation or state, yes.
So if it's public road, public lands, public park, it belongs to us, not to the government.
People of a nation or state.
Damn, I thought the government owned it. Because they say you can't come in the park after 8 o'clock. You can't go on this public road because we said you can't. You can't camp on that public land because it's ours. Now, let's look at it. It belongs to us. But, hey, if we go back to colonial times, they had road reeves, they had fence reeves, they had hog reeves, they had all these reeves. These reeves were people who had the responsibility to make sure that in the case of hogs, that your hogs didn't get loose and cause damage. In the case of fences, that your fences were maintained and were on your property. And in the case of roads, road reeves, their job was to make sure that you maintained the road in front of your property. Maintain the road in front of your property. If the road came up, everybody's property was on the road. That's how they got home. So everybody had a portion of road that they had to maintain. There wasn't a public works department or a highway department to take care of it. So the concept of the public graves was to, they could fine people. The administration could fine people for not keeping their road maintained. So let's go after the revolution and starting looking at, let's look at something practical, especially in towns like Boston and all this. What we need to do is consolidate this effort into a group of people that are equipped and have the machinery or the wherewithal to achieve the maintenance of a public road. So what we'll do is we'll have a little tax, and that tax will go into a fund, and that fund will be used then to maintain the roads and bridges and things like that. Interesting concept. It's a good concept. But what happened is, and from a surveyor standpoint, you have underlying title to the road in front of your house. You own that. If the road ever is abandoned, then you, that land reverts. Underlying title, reversionary rights, it reverts back to you. So you still own it, but it's collectively maintained through taxes, and those taxes nowadays and for the last century almost have been excise taxes on tires and batteries, and gas taxes have been used to pay for the collective or consolidated application of maintaining the roads. It took the burden off of the people that lived on the road of having to maintain it itself. So it was a good deal. It was practiced, and the practice grew throughout the country. Let's consolidate it, and we'll get more efficient roads, and I'll have more time for my crops or whatever I'm doing. And I won't have to mess with the road. So what happened is the public road then, which in this concept goes back in English history for over 1,000 years, public roads, that everybody has a right to travel a public road. Even the king could not stop people from traveling the public road. He could stop them from leaving the public road to his property, but he could not stop them from traveling the public road. So the public roads belong to everybody, us, the public. And all the government is, it's a caretaker. They have been given by us the responsibility of maintaining that road, not to own it. That's true of the public parks. That's true of the public lands. They're ours. And as long as we're not destructive of them, we should have every right to use them. But the government acts as the owner of the public. And so when we look at the term public now, our first inclination is to think, well, the government, the city government, the county government, state government, federal government, whatever it is, our first inclination is to associate public with the government, not with our property. Our property, ours.
Commonly held property.
Commonly held property. It's undivided interest. Somebody brought up in a conversation once, well, if it belongs to all of us, can't I want to sell my share of it? Well, you can't sell your share. It's what's, in legal terms, undivided interest. It's not divisible. You can't divide it. If 10 of us own 10 acres of land in undivided interest, I can't sell an acre of it. But if we have divided interest and each of us owns an acre, then I can sell my acre to somebody else as long as there's not a prohibition in the original contract to that. But if it's undivided interest, no, it can't be divided. Therefore, I can't sell my interest in it. So we achieve that interest by birth, and we lose that interest by death. It is not a part of our estate that goes to our children, because our children acquired their interest at birth, and we lose ours at death. So that's the concept of public as existed 200 years ago. Now, in your own mind, figure out how you react to the word public when it's presented to you. That's a public park. You can't go in there. Oh.
Yeah. Well, you're right about that. The government has changed from being a caretaker to acting as if they were the owner. And in terms of their, I'm going to use the term loosely, but in terms of their customer service, it's pretty terrible. I mean, goodness sakes. I mean, like I told you privately before, and this is a good example that I'll mention here, is that, I was traveling on the public road, and one of those, I guess, a caretaker, guy in a blue uniform, kind of had a swagger.
Bubblegum machine with lights on the top. Yeah,
yeah, one of those strange beings basically had a problem with my privately owned automobile because it didn't happen to have a specific sticker on it. Needless to say, the matter was resolved later, but I kind of found his attitude and the whole purpose behind the traffic stop really just kind of arbitrary and And he kind of acted like he owned the road too. I mean, very authoritarian from start to finish. Well, and so I don't see how he's being a good caretaker, especially since I caused no damage to person or property.
You know, in Phoenix, Arizona, they shut down the road if there's a traffic fatality. They call it a crime scene, and they shut down the road, which surveyor in Florida, the county could close a road for up to 24 hours. Then it had to remain open 24 hours before they could close it again for 24 hours. There were exceptions, but they had to have a detour, a suitable detour for any of those exceptions. So they couldn't just close the road. They still recognized in the law, and these laws date back over 100 years, that they can't close a road because I have to be able to get from here to there because that's my road. But one thing interesting, too, is if the county wants, there's a road going by your property and they want more width to build a bigger road, they used to acquire what's called a right-of-way. Right-of-way has reversionary rights. Now, they started doing something funny, and this is back in the 70s, and I thought it was rather curious. They didn't want a right-of-way agreement, and the right-of-way agreements go back hundreds of years. They are in agreement for them to use it for public road purposes with the reversionary right. They wanted, for the same money, because they had to buy the right-of-way agreement, for the same money, they wanted a warranty deed. They wanted you to warrant your ownership and give them fee title to it, which means that they were trying to undo that whole concept of reversionary rights, or they were trying to get to where the government did actually own the road because it was deeded to them, just like the land the courthouse is on, where it's owned land, not public land. So there's been a subtle shift, verbicide, with the word of public, where we have come to generally accept the premise that, oh, that's government.
Yeah, and I mean, and fortunately, you know, some of us are actually using the word public correctly. And a just quick example is that, you know, obviously all of our, you know, episodes here at OPF Radio are, you know, for public consumption. Now, if I were to talk to somebody privately, you know, on a call or something, that is to be, you know, private and held confidential. But otherwise, all our other stuff that we make available for everyone on the internet is public. We're not talking, when I say that word, I don't mean like, that has nothing to do with government. Government could be abolished, but I would still say we're making this public.
Yeah, and that gets back to the original context of the public, the general, anybody has benefit or access to it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, and just like I mentioned earlier with marriage and welfare, I guess the closest thing to proof positive confirmation about how public has been verbicided was kind of reminds me of an article Murray Rothbard wrote once about the private sector versus the public sector. And, you know, his economic analysis was rather interesting, but that's not really what I want to point out here. What I do want to point out is that he was taking it as a given that public, when he said public sector referred to the government, and he just took that as a given. He didn't contest that at all. He just stuck to the more, you know, what he was good at, which was his economic analysis. So, but even he was committing verbicide. So even a lot of the guys who are the smart bookworm types still commit verbicide with the word public and think it means government.
He was educated in a public school, which is really a government school. So, how does that work? Oh, right. They stole the public schools from us, too, because the public schools used to be run by a school district, school board. Elements of civil government talks about the school district. And the people of the community paid for the teacher, paid for the building. The land sometimes came from the government, believe it or not. Section 16 in the growth lands was set aside for public schools belonging to the people. But they maintained it. They decided who the teachers were, what the curriculum was, and everything was decided locally to suit the needs of the people in that community, the public in that community. And as you said, it could be the nation, the state, the county, the city. The school district, that was a public geographic entity, and those people decided what was. Well, the government has taken that over because of the distortion of the word public, and so now public schools belong to the government, and they dictate to some extent what can be used as a textbook. They dictate to some degree the curriculum, and now they're dictating what you have to learn before you get out of school, and it has nothing to do with, well, this was our last program, wasn't it? Public education. Has nothing to do with being able to go out in the world and fend for yourself. It has only, it is only to satisfy that the teachers are doing what they're told to do, just doing their job. So.
Right, and actually in that definition for public, it's said about pertaining to a nation, state, or community. So I guess we should move on towards our next word, which was state, which is defined as condition, circumstances of a being or thing at any given time. These circumstances may be internal, constitutional, or peculiar to the being, or they may have relation to other beings. We say the body's in a sound state, or it is in a weak state, or it has just recovered from a feeble state. Also, the state of his health is good, the state of his mind is favorable to study, so on and so forth.
Well, do you have another definition there? Because I think you're talking about a different state than we're talking about when we talk about the state. Is there another one there?
Let's see, another definition for state under Webster's 1828 is a political body or body politic.
Yeah, the that's the body, noun as opposed to the verb transitive, I think.
Right. A political body or body politic, the whole body of people united under one government, whatever may be the form of the government.
So we live in the state of the United States, the state of, in your case, Texas, a state of the county, and a state of the city. That's the public entity, the management of the public trust, right?
Yes, I guess that you could say that there are different political communities or bodies politic or different states, not to be confused with the 50 states of the Union.
Now, body politics is an interesting word. It was used in the Mayflower Compact. It was used at Jamestown. It's been prevalent in our history. And the body politic, interestingly, is comprised of the public. And they had the town meetings where everybody in town could go and vote if they qualified to vote. If they were slaves or Indians or women, they couldn't vote. But the concept was there, that body politic. Now, the state has slowly transitioned into another form, whether it be city, county, state, or federal, where those people elected are the determining factor. And so again, we see a transition, a subtle one, but a transition to the authority of the state resides in the five people on the board, or the seven people, or the nine people, or the 435 people, or the 536 people, or whatever way we want to look at it. We've transferred the concept of body politic to one of an entity called the government, and we recognize the state as the government. These people that are statists, if it meant them, they wouldn't. That accused people of being statist, if they realized that they were the state, and we were back to the concept of body politic, that they were part of the state as much as anybody else. And, you know, you and I have had conversations about anarchy, and I think if they lived in republicanism, they'd see that it's about as close as you can get to anarchy, because you can establish a community with the moral values and whatever you want. Now, the idea of state then is not the authoritarian nature of state that we've come to accept today, which is where the word statist comes from. Rather, it was the body politic, which was the Mayflower Compact, Jamestown, and many of the early settlements in this country, and all the way through and after the Revolutionary War, there were body politics that were the government, where everybody that was legally qualified was a participant in the decisions of that community. And again, we're looking at public and being the government, and or being the people, and the state, again, could be the government or the people. And that shift in verbicide has shifted our connotation of state to be the government. The state says, well, I didn't say.
Right, right. It's a very, right. And, you know, under republicanism, you know, it's supposed to be, I think you mentioned it once before about that, in the notion of like the inverted pyramid where the people are on top. Right. But unfortunately, Red Beckman, thank you. But unfortunately, it's now been meaning to really, I guess the best word to describe it is really Leviathan, a form of absolute government where it is top down, dictatorial, you know, you better obey or be punished type dictates, really.
So you're beginning to see the effect of verbicide on the way we think, aren't you?
Yeah, and you see, it's kind of unfortunate, too, because even in libertarian circles that I usually spend a lot of time in, it is pretty common to call folks who are in favor or who either directly benefit from or who just happen to verbally support Leviathan as statists, i.e. those who worship government. But I see what you mean, because actually state, the old 1828 definition, is just a body politic.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't mean, or at least doesn't necessarily mean a Leviathan absolute, you know, top-down, dictatorial, pretty much authoritarian absolute government.
Well, you're beginning to unlearn, aren't you?
But it also shows that even libertarians make mistakes, even about some basic things, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, unless somebody else can come up with a better word for statist than statist, actually, just people who just support the Leviathan. I mean, that's what it's supposed to mean. But
well,
let's move on
to a rather abstract word.
Okay, let's see. I think this one is progress.
Oh, geez.
Oh, lovely progress. Here's Webster's 1828. A moving or going forward, a proceeding onward. A man makes a slow progress or a rapid progress on a journey. A ship makes slow progress against the tide. So on and so forth.
Okay, man makes progress in a journey or a ship makes progress in his transit. Does man have a purpose when he's making progress on that journey? Is there a goal with that?
One could be inferred or implied, sure.
Well, let's look at two. Okay, I'm going down the road, and I'm going from Hartford, Connecticut to Boston, Massachusetts. I'm making progress in my journey. Let's look at another way of looking at that. I'm an apprentice, and I'm learning how to be a silversmith, and my goal is silversmithing. Let's look at the ship. They don't go to sea just to go around in circles. They have a destination, a port of call that they intend to go to next. Progress has an objective. It has a purpose. It's going somewhere. It has a meaning to it, or supposed to. So people talk about we're making progress with the Civil Rights Act. What was that progress?
Yeah.
Okay, pardon me, I don't have the author readily available, but the book is called The Southern South. It was written in the early 1900s, and he is talking about George Washington Carver, and he talks about a book that he wrote, The Future of the American Negro, published in 1899, is the only volume in which George Carver Washington discusses the race problem as a whole. And his advice here, as in all his public utterances, is for the Negro to show himself so thrifty and so useful that the community cannot get on without him. That was over 100 years ago. Then comes
Wow.
The civil rights movement. And we made progress, because now they don't have to be thrifty, because they got a regular check coming in every month to buy their drugs, their whores, and their they don't have to be useful. In fact, they're anything but useful, many of them. So that's the progression. The slave problem was a problem in this country from the beginning, and it was understood, and it had to be tolerated. And then the Civil War kind of ended it. In many parts of the country, Negroes were treated like everybody else. There were still, especially in the South, even when I was young traveling through the South, I saw sharecroppers' cabins, and people were treated differently. But many of them fled to Massachusetts and other places where they were treated more as equals. And then comes the Civil Rights Movement, under the guise of progress, and everything's gone downhill since then. Think about it. in the name of progress. So when we talk about progress, when the government says this is progress, when anybody says this is progress, the important question they ask them, what is the goal?
Yeah, progress towards what?
Yes, because we accept that progress is progress. Well, it's got to be a good thing because it sounds good. Progress, pro, good, yes. Got to be a good thing. And we're oblivious to where we're going. Now, all these words of verbicide that we've talked about before, I'm sure the definitions were changed as a part of progress.
Yeah, obviously, if the word was regress, obviously, it would be kind of a little bit hard to verbicide that one. But progress is definitely susceptible to that. And in fact, it kind of reminds me of this one interview Adam Kokesh did with Mainline.
Let me interrupt here. Progress is verbicided by truncation.
How do you mean?
Rather than progress, knowing what the goal is, we just talk progress. We truncate for the goal of or for the objective of. We truncate the definition. Just say progress. It stands alone. What more need I say? Progress. This is progress.
That's vague and unclear.
It is, because it's been truncated. Because the objective of the progress, whether I'm going to Boston, whether I'm pursuing an education, whether my ship is going, what if a ship went to sea and made progress but didn't know where it was going? And that's exactly where we are.
Yeah.
The ship of state decides which port we're going to, and we find out after we get there. Maybe we don't even find out after we got there.
Again, progress towards what? You know, this kind of reminds me of one interview Adam Kokesh did with a Mainline talk show host whose name was David Pakman. And David Pakman, when Kokesh was basically pushing him for what he meant, what is your political philosophy? And Pakman said his political philosophy was, I am a progressive. And so he kept pushing him and like, well, this is what I mean by progressive. Anything, and this is what David Pakman said, anything that is old is bad. And thus we, the eponymous we, need to be moving forward and progressing. And this is very key, any sort of progress is good. That's what David Pakman said. And I was just so floored by that. I actually had to rewind the video and rewatch that one, you know, 1 or 2 minute segment. So that's progress. Progress is just moving towards anything with no goal in mind.
Right, and who is in control? Who is behind the verbicide? The government? And their allies, the press, and their functionaries, individuals who have the government's interested mind. John McCain's probably a good example. They know what the goal is.
But that's what a progressive is.
Yeah. They won't tell us. So when somebody tells you it's progress, say, where are we going? What is this progression towards?
And I have a sincere fear that the progressives, quote unquote, the progressives won't tell you what the progress is going towards. And it's you know, it kind of reminds me a little bit, just as a synonym of sorts, Gary, kind of the word movement, almost. You know, I hear about this movement, that movement, heck, even the Patriot movement. And again, it's like movement, okay, but movement toward what? I mean, it's almost kind of very similar in some ways. I mean, it's one thing to talk about the Patriot community, sure. But again, progress, movement, again, towards what? What is the end goal? What are, or even just some signposts, like goalposts, or anything, a way to measure activity. There isn't anything of that as far as I'm aware. That's kind of what's disconcerting and what makes the word progress so verbicided is because there's no way to measure the activity in question.
Without asking that fundamental question, what are we making progress towards? Totalitarian state?
A republic? Heck, even what some people want, which is a stateless society. But the point, it doesn't matter which one it is, just what is it? I don't know. I mean, that's the problem here. That's why progress is verbicided.
Okay, the next one is rather abstract, too, because, it goes in a funny direction.
Oh, yes, equality. defined as an agreement of things in dimension, quantity or quality, likeness, similarity in regard to two things compared. For example, we speak of the equality of two or more tracts of land, of two bodies in length, two breadth of thickness, of virtues or vices.
Okay, now from our history, founding documents, we find equality mentioned a couple times. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve their political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station. Well, that's a good one. That applies. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Oh, that's a good one. That applies, too. Now, we've got those two references to equal in the Declaration of Independence. But let's look at equal or equality. There were groups called levelers early in this country. And in a sense, Plymouth and Jamestown, it began on the leveling concept that everybody's equal. Everybody puts in the common store, and everybody takes out of the common store based upon their needs. It wasn't very motivational, because why should I work hard? Because if I work hard and grow extra potatoes and extra chickens, I only get my share of chickens, the equal share of chickens coming out. The input was not equal, but the output was equal. Jamestown similarly, and in both of these, eventually they realized that private ownership of the land plot or anything else would, that private ownership encouraged people to produce more, especially if they could retain at least some of that. But when we look at equality in these two contexts, equal station, we were not in that first phrase in the Declaration of Independence. The founders were looking to be treated equally as the rights of Englishmen. And they were being denied those, whether it be taxation or many other aspects. They were not being treated equally with the people in England. But they were in England, too, because England was over here in the new part of England. They are endowed with their creator. We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. Okay, at birth, they're equal. And the world's ahead of them. They have equal footing. As a product of their birth, there is no limitation on what they can achieve, and that's equal. Now, as we go into achieving, we're back to Jamestown, Plymouth Colony, and the levelers. Why is it that if I work harder, they're going to take from me and give it to somebody not willing to work at all? Shouldn't he work equally with me? That's what the definition says, equal parts, that they're comparable.
Yeah.
But we looked at equality as if I've got a color television that I earned, that guy deserves a color television whether he earned it or not.
Back to welfare, right?
Back to welfare. And so the term equality is abused seriously, because it's not a matter of a state or a condition of things, equality. It's a matter of leveling, bringing, and it's happening in schools too, I guess the best way to explain this, back in the anti-war days, I was somewhat of a liberal. I hate to admit it, but I was looking at going to college in Florida, and I was talking to my father, and I said, hey, Bethune-Cookman, that's a Negro college. Maybe I'll go there. And he says, well, you can go there, but if you want an education, I'd suggest you go somewhere else. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Bethune College teaches to Negroes. And for the most part, Negroes don't have a good foundational education, and they seem to be, in most cases, relatively slow learners. My father was an educator, so I believe him. And I think he's right, that what was being taught was being brought down to the level of the audience. Now, when we go to public education, we see the same thing. I went to school early on in Palos Verdes School District in California. And there were a lot of intelligent kids. They were a fairly wealthy neighborhood. And so I had algebra in the sixth grade. But we only had primary school there. And so when it got to junior high, I had to go into the L.A. school district. So in the ninth grade, it was mandatory that I take algebra again, because the paper said so. So I learned early on that, and this is, you know, an aspect of public education that's pretty important. If you've got a neighborhood where the people are above average, the parents spend time educating their children at home and investing in their children's future, why should those children be brought down to the level of others? That equal quality. We can't give you a better education because no child can be left behind. What a concept. Let's screw 80% of the people to appease the 20% that are unwilling to invest in their own future. All under the guise of equality.
Yeah, and actually to kind of confirm that the word has been verbicided, I happen to have here my handy-dandy poli-sci freshman textbook, you know, collegiate freshman, and they have five different kinds of alleged equality. We have everything from political equality to legal equality to social equality to economic equality, which is really communism, and equality of opportunity, which is rather strange. It kind of seems really that there's so many different types of equality that I don't know if they're really even equal to each other, quite honestly.
Well, equality of opportunity is kind of interesting because it depends on where you draw the line. Does it mean anybody can apply for this job, or everybody that applies for the job is considered equal once they've submitted their application regarding of their background, their education, and their experience?
Well, they define it thusly as meaning the right of every individual to develop to the fullest extent of his or her abilities.
But how can he do that if you can't let him be president of the company after he's done pushing the broom?
Right, right. Well,
let's look at something we talked about earlier. We talked about civil rights, too. And then the various amendments were called civil rights amendments or equal rights amendments. This is where they began codifying equitable, let me be honest, inequitable distribution of our personal property.
Right.
Inequitable distribution under the guise of equality, equal rights. Again, remember, if rights are natural. Civil rights and equal rights are given by government. And yeah, so the government's the determiner on what equality is, and if that equality means that everybody's going to graduate from school with the same education, then some have to be brought down because it's easier to bring somebody down than it is to move somebody up.
Right.
You can't take an idiot and make him smart, but you can take a smart person and keep him from getting smarter.
Yeah, so what, we can all be equally mediocre?
Well, 1984 came and went.
Yep, it did. Both the actual year and in some ways even the kind of thing that they were describing. Well, I think when it comes to equality, I think what a lot of people are kind of getting tripped up on, and I think where it's being verbicided, Gary, I think most directly corresponds to what this mainstream college political science textbook defined as social equality, that is defined as the idea that people should be free of class or social barriers and discrimination.
Right. He's as qualified to be president of the corporation as anybody else. That's what I said.
Yeah. Well, supposedly that was different from the other form of equality. But then, wait, maybe they're not really different from each other. Maybe it's all the same cesspool of, you know, mess.
Well, let's compare it to horse racing. Okay. Horse racing has a starting gate. All horses start equal. What if they moved that starting gate to the finish line so they all finished equal? Would you call it a horse race?
I'd call it really lame and probably a lot of cheating, too.
Isn't that what we're doing, though? We're moving the starting gate, equality, at the beginning, and then you develop what you can out of that, run faster or slower. Instead, we're moving the starting gate to the end of college, high school, all schools, even employment, putting that starting gate at the end so that everybody will be equal at the finish.
Yeah. It's just, ugh. And then, of course, people like to, you know, mention about what Jefferson wrote in the Declaration about all men are created equal and whatnot, and then they kind of spin off into 20,000 different directions from there, don't they?
Well, we're back to promoting or providing, huh, aren't we? Are we promoting equality or are we providing equality?
Yeah, just like welfare, just like charity. Oh, goodness sakes. Okay.
In well, the name of the public, meaning the state.
Exactly, exactly. Oh, it's like it's one big carnival. It really is.
Now, anybody well, over 30 or 40 years old is really going to appreciate the changes they've seen in this next word.
Gay, defined by Webster's 1828 as merry, airy, jovial, sportive, and frolicsome. It is supposed to denote more life and animation than the word cheerful.
Whoa, where do we start with this? I like to watch old black and white movies, old black and white television series. Donna Reed Show, for example, they were going to a gay party one night. What's a gay party? Oh, that's a bunch of queers together? No. Gay party is where we're going to go tell jokes and slap our legs and laugh and just, you know, have a few drinks and just have a gay old time. There's that word again. Damn. Gay people were happy. I mean, you've probably met somebody like this. They're always happy, always smiley. They're good-natured people.
Yeah, happy-go-lucky types.
Happy-go-lucky.
Right.
Gay was a commonly used word, and it never had a bad connotation. It was a good one, unless you just wanted to relax and, you know, you're making too much noise. Shut the up and leave me alone. That would be the only time that it had a bad connotation, when you were trying to sleep or relax or have some quiet. But you could always leave the room too, I suppose. But now, what's happened to that word? Let's see. Let's look at queers. Some of the old terms for queers. One was fags or faggots, and that came from the pieces of wood they put around them when they burned them at the stake. Well, I'm not saying that's the solution. Homosexual, that's the technical term for them. Queers, that's what they've been called for a very long time because they are rather queer in their relationships. They're appropriate. Are they derogatory? Well, they have decided that they should be considered derogatory, and they wanted a word that was not derogatory, was not impugning upon their right to civil right to equality. And so they grabbed a word called gay and started calling themselves gay people. So we had a word that for centuries at least was used to describe somebody that was happy, carefree, joyful, good connotation. So we've got what is considered to be morally bad. Not evil, not punishable by death necessarily, though it used to be, but it's frowned upon. So how do we change people's perception of queers? We take a good word, and there's an article on my page called Freedom of Speech that deals with this. We take a good word, and we grab it, we steal it. And so when people say gay, they think gay, frivolous, happy, joyful. And then that attribute is assigned to us. We're designated gay people. So we're happy. We're not morally degenerate or anything. There's nothing wrong with us. We're gay people. So what happens in our minds now? We can't use gay anymore because it'll be misconstrued. If I'm going to a gay party, I didn't know you were queer. I'm going to a gay bar. Oh, you're going to that kind of bar? What, are you trying to get picked up or something? I can't use the word anymore by choice because of the connotation that's given to a word that used to have one meaning. So now I got to call these people gay. And so my mind says gay does not mean happy, frivolous, joyful anymore. It means queer. But that's a good word. So that association goes to the queers as a good word. And I've been denied the use of a word that's existed for centuries. I can't use it. Because in context, it will be taken wrong. I cannot use it anymore. It's been stolen from me. Remember, words are the rule. Definitions of words are the rules of the game of communication. And they have to have a meaning that we understand. And so I'm denied the use of the word gay. Well, I'm intolerant. Since the word's been taken away and I can't use it, I won't. I'm going to call them queers. I'm going to continue to call them queers. There's nothing wrong with that. I've had two very close friends in my life that were queers. One in California, I used to ride in parades with him, and another one in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where he helped me get on my feet after I got out of jail in both Ford and Pennsylvania, both places. They helped me get on my feet. He gave me a job working on his old 1927 Rolls Royce, and back then paid me $10 an hour for that. And it turned me around, gave me the means to rebuild my life. They're good friends. I still respect them. And neither one of them ever tried to put the make on me. But they're queers. And queers tended to stay in the closet. Sandy, the guy in Pittsburgh, he got a job in Annapolis, Maryland, and he said they can't, for the government, and he said they can't know what I am because if they do, I'll lose my job. So he had to stay in the closet to go there. He didn't have any problem with that. But I can't use gay anymore. And my mind says you can't use gay. But if I call a queer gay, then I'm giving him an attribute that he does not deserve. For theft, he deserves to be treated more respectfully than before he stole that word from me. But freedom of speech then begins to affect freedom of thought. Because I can't think gay anymore. I can't use the word gay unless I'm willing to attribute it to somebody who stole it. So my mind, after a while, gets the habit of not using gay. And so my whole thought process, not just my speech, but my whole thought process is affected detrimentally as a consequence of verbiciding the word gay.
That's rather interesting, Gary, because that suggests that verbicide inherently infringes upon the freedom of thought, which is a very, again, which like real charity is a very human thing, all virtually universal.
Right.
Oh, wow.
So it does, because it happened in such a short and conspicuous period of time that is probably it's the word that I used to write freedom of speech, which is also about freedom of thought. It addresses the same things I've just talked about. It's the epitome, because most of us in our lifetime have seen this transition, the theft of one word, the verbiciding of one word.
Yeah, and quite honestly, I just don't see how it is progress. How some individuals would view it as progressive for homosexuals to be considered equal when they go to the government for a marriage license, or they want to get the ability to go to the government to get a marriage license. I mean, again, as you can see, I just strung together a bunch of the verbicided words. And hell, you can throw gay in there too. I mean,
Social engineering. We have demonstrated social engineering by throwing all these words together, haven't we?
Yeah, and so technically, if you want, as a probably the best example, is that the whole really football issue of what is colloquially referred to as gay marriage is literally littered with verbicided words. Again, progressing for the equality of gay people to get a marriage license, which is begging the government for permission. Like, that makes no sense. And the unfortunate thing, too, it's actually worse for one other reason.
Well, the reason they do that, though, is they want welfare, right? Because they want the financial benefits that come as a consequence of being married. So it's not to be married as much as to get the welfare benefits, the freebies that the government's willing to hand out, or to force your employer to give you. So it is welfare, too. So let's throw welfare in the mix.
Yeah,
here.
And if you don't, You know, if you don't agree to that theft by way of government, then you are being intolerant and wait for it, uncharitable. Right, right. And the worst thing too, Gary, is for another reason I just thought of. You know, there are homosexuals who understand what Leviathan is, and they also understand that you know, getting a marriage license or you know, advocating for, well, we should have the ability to get a marriage license. Some of them even don't like it. And a good example I can think of is Dale Everett, who is one of the free staters up in New Hampshire. He has publicly said multiple times over, you know, basically, I am a homosexual and I don't want government marriage. And that's how he describes it. And what he's referring to is the marriage license thing. But, you know, that's what's worse. I mean, it's not about someone's sexual orientation.
Let's go one step further. The bastard president recently made a phone call to an athletic figure who came out of the closet and admitted being openly to be gay and congratulated him for being gay. would he have congratulated him for being queer?
No.
Oh, well.
And I hope that guy is very happy. But you're right. I mean, the problem with the verbicide is that a lot of these words, not just gay, are basically being stolen. It reminds me a lot of, you know, you mentioned about Orwell's 1984 book, and it was described in there about the notion of newspeak, where it's not just you're getting rid of words in the dictionary and all that, but you retain some words, but through common usage and, you know, indoctrination and propaganda and stuff like that, you essentially reduce the sphere of meaning for a particular word. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, what's happened here as well. And again, with gay, if somebody says gay now, the first thing they think is homosexual, not happy-go-lucky, you know, let's just say stereotypically Irish type or something. So that word's been reduced down to mean one thing primarily.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on the next one.
Ah, yes, and on that, relating to the string of verbicided words which could be used to explain a single policy item, I guess, as the government would like to say, is diversity.
Oh, one of my favorite cartoons.
defined by Webster's 1828 as difference, dissimilitude, and unlikeness. For example, there may be diversity without contrariety, good SAT word. There is a great diversity in human constitutions.
So that basically means different, yes, yes.
Yeah.
My favorite cartoon. Ah, I loved this one when I saw it. I had to pick myself up off the floor and take a deep breath to get the air back in my body. It was a cartoon of a class in school. And everybody had a diversity T-shirt on except one guy. The instructor even had a diversity T-shirt on. And, you know, I'm getting old. I don't remember the exact word. But this guy was being chastised for not wearing the diversity T-shirt. When I was a kid, Southern California, there were hodads. These are the guys with greased hair, pig pants, you know, a class of people. And there was another class called the Surfer, and they wore Jack Purcell tennis shoes, blue Levi's, and a white T-shirt, and quite often peroxided their hair blonde to make it look like they'd spent the whole summer at the beach. Interestingly, we thought we were being different by being surfers. But I guess that was a form of diversity, even though we were all dressing the same way, Jack Purcell tennis shoes, blue Levi's, and a white T-shirt, and peroxided hair. But if the only guy that is diverse in this class is being chastised for being diverse in a diversity class, I don't know. To me, that just strikes me as hilarious.
Yeah, very oxymoronic, because obviously if everyone's wearing the exact same T-shirt with the exact same colors and words on it, I don't think that's being very diverse. It sounds very hegemonic to me.
Well, now we're in 1984 because war is peace and, all those expressions they had. Doesn't diversity in this context mean conformity?
Yes, yes. And to put an Orwellian slogan spin on it, yes, diversity is conformity.
Right. It's acknowledgement of a non-existent truth.
Again, it might as well be war is peace, ignorance is strength. Just tag that one up. It's diversity is conformity.
Yes. Yeah. Acknowledgement of a non-existent truth.
Yep. And of course, you know,
That's political correctness, though. That's getting people to conform using nonconformity as the excuse to force conformity.
Again, like in that novel said, doublethink, hold two completely contradictory ideas in your head simultaneously and believe in both of them completely and absolutely.
Right.
So I love asparagus and I hate asparagus. Well, somebody else, well, do you like asparagus or do you not? Well, no, you didn't listen. I like asparagus, I love asparagus, and I hate asparagus. And I'm a good little citizen.
Now, this comes to something that came out of Waco when I realized that one of the tactics of government, now I don't think I coined the word, though I lay claim to it, the word is befuddlement in this definition, this application. And this is not verbicide, it's an effort to exemplify or demonstrate something. When I've got opposing thoughts, I like asparagus, I don't like asparagus, you're not being diverse because you're not wearing the diversity t-shirt, I've got conflicting thoughts. So when I've got conflicting thoughts, how do I resolve that? That's befuddlement. Now, when you're befuddled and don't know what to do, where do you turn? Well, let's turn to the state, to the public, to the government, and say, what's the answer? You tell me. And when they're done telling me, I'm equally befuddled, but now I can shrug my shoulders, walk away, and say, I guess I understand.
All the while totally not understanding just as much as you did before, which was to say not at all.
Well, what you're saying is I'm not going to deal with the problem.
Yeah,
have to deal with the problem, because if we don't, we're going to be verbicided to death.
Yeah, figuratively and more likely than not, literally. Yeah, it's and what you're describing with befuddlement is, you know, the more, you know, scientific term technically is cognitive dissonance, and it's the same thing. It's when you have these these contradictory premises, and cognitive dissonance needs to be resolved. And generally speaking, you do that by either picking one, the other, or a completely different option, or you know that can either be a synthesis of the two. If that's even possible, usually not, or just a third way or a completely different other thing. But the point is the cognitive dissonance regardless has to be resolved. Otherwise, you're just a walking contradiction, and too many people are. And then everyone wonders why, you know, there's a bunch of tyrants and so on and so forth.
Okay, on to the next one.
Speaking of tyrants, in one sense anyway, the word collective, defined by Webster's 1828 as formed by gathering, gathered into a mass, sum, or body, congregated or aggregated.
Interesting word, collective. It has a meaning, and I'll tell you the context. This is an associative verbicide. I'm going to put it that way. A little background. Back in 1993, when I started looking into how the Founding Fathers brought together the means of kicking England out of the country, to be polite about it, ran across committees of safety. So I started talking about committee safety, putting out facts articles in committees of safety, especially in the Sons of Liberty series, which is online at my webpage. And Linda Thompson, my nemesis, said, committees of public safety, look what they did in France. They cut everybody's head off. That's associative. She tried to destroy the concept that built this country. There would be, I'm going to put it bluntly, after reading history, the history of communities of safety, there would have been no United States of America had there not been committees of safety. They were the root. They were the source. They were the bringing together of groups of people to achieve kicking the British out of this country. They were collectives. Collective. Oh, that's a communist term. I've used it in discussing committees of safety and militia. Militia is collective self-defense. But when I use collective self-defense, they say, oh, I don't want to be a communist. I can't use the word collective. This is an associative destruction. And, you know, just like Linda Thompson was trying to demean committees of safety, apparently she had no appreciation for this country or its foundations. By the same token, we have used collective in this country from the beginning. Let's go back to Jamestown or Mayflower, Plymouth Colony. It was a collective. And that collective managed to get a foothold here, one of the earliest footholds. And that foothold grew rather rapidly. The pilgrims came for decades after that, coming onto this land. But that first collective established the foothold and began a process that eventually came all the way to California from way up yonder. That was a collective. It's not a communist term. But who would want to make words that were used then bad now? Who benefits by that? By discouraging a thought process back to freedom of thought, if collective is bad and we can't use collective because it has communist connotations, then we can't talk about working together to achieve a common goal or collective goal. We can't have collective committees of safety or collective body politics or collective self-defense in the form of collective militias. So these are destructive terms by association.
Yeah, and even in libertarian circles, Gary, I mean, I've heard about, oh, you know, so-and-so's acting like a collectivist and that's bad. He's doing groupthink. And I think, again, kind of like the word state, very similarly, kind of like the word collective. So you have these words that are verbicided, but then you add on the suffix of ism, statism, collectivism, and it becomes something completely different.
But it carries the root word with it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Again, state, statism, collective, collectivism. Yeah, it does carry.
So it carries. So we're freedom of speech and freedom of thought are both affected by it. But I'm going to use the term collective, and I'm going to use the word queer. You know, screw you. I'm going to use them.
Fair enough.
I'm not going to undo over six decades of education. No way. Mm. Okay, now we go to another one that is associated with collective, and that is...
Hold on, let me just check here.
It's the one you don't have a definition for.
Oh, yes, of course. Capitalism, which I don't have a definition for.
Capitalism. Oh, that's a collective. A group of people with financial resources come together to build something that one of them or two of them or three of them alone could not possibly achieve. To do so, they sell shares based on the contribution. There's always the guys that get free ones just for coming up with the idea. But basically, the distribution of the shares is proportionate to the amount of contribution, whether in thought or work or venture capital. It's a collective. But the idea behind it was, I'm becoming a businessman. I've got one-tenth of the shares in this corporation that we've put together to achieve, well, let's say making widgets. And now we're making widgets, and I'm making a profit on it. And so each year I get a dividend out of that. Now, capitalism at its inception was that I invest and I get a return on that investment. And what the, I can't think of the term, it was three letters in the newspaper, but it's the dividend, the annual dividend you get, what percentage of your investment you were getting back in the dividend. And if you got 3 or 4%, that wasn't a bad deal. You know, if you got over 10%, that was really a good deal. But the idea is it was an investment. Now, somewhere along the line, though, and capitalism was a good thing because things could be achieved that could not otherwise be achieved. And the growth of this country was based on capitalism in that concept where I'm investing. I'm one of the business owners, and I receive dividends, my share of the profits as a contributor, to be able to create this enterprise that can do what one man or two men or three men alone could not achieve. So capitalism was good back then. But then comes some machinations by government, some machinations by stockbrokers. The more I can sell something and get a commission each time, the more I can make. So what they did is they made a mini Las Vegas out of Wall Street. It's no longer the dividends. It's the increase in value of the stock. And that's obviously apparent now. I don't know where Google makes their money, and I don't know why they're worth, you know, they can buy for cash billions of dollars of other businesses. Where do they make their money? I don't give them any money. If I go down and buy a soda pop, I know that the money, some of it goes back to the people that bottled the soda pop. If I buy a house, somebody built the house, owned the land and all that, so they got a profit out of it. I don't buy anything from Google. And I guess it's all advertising revenue and something like that, but when people buy stock like that, it's not based on the dividends that are paid. It's based upon speculation, a future value. And the Silicon Valley stocks really got this on a roll. But this is true back, the reason for the Great Depression, a lot of it, and the failure on Wall Street, was the fact that it was speculative and it was based on future value. And yes, there were day traders back then, but they were actually week traders that, because they didn't have the resources to do day trading. But people were speculating on future value as opposed to the return on the investment. So capitalism has gone from one thing, which was good, to something that is no different than what happens in Las Vegas. But and let's look at both taxes and commissions. You put $1,000 in the stock market, the guy that sold you the shares is going to get a good chunk of that $1,000. When you sell, he's going to take a good chunk out of what it sold for, too, that you're going to pay coming and going. He's getting filthy rich by having converted capitalism, a good thing, into basically a gambling situation. And so when people say capitalism is bad, again, it was foundational to the growth of this country. Nowhere else in the world could anybody have crossed 3,000 miles of open raw territory with industry, production, living, railroads, roads, and everything. No time in history has anybody ever achieved that except in this country. Capitalism was fundamental to that being achieved. But now, capitalism, by thinking people, is understood to be gambling and nothing more than that. They don't buy stock looking for the annual dividend check to supplement their income. They gamble. They go into mutual funds, which are a gamble. They've got high-yield ones, which are more risky. They've got low-yield ones that are more stable. You know, the world has changed, and the word capitalism has actually become a bad word to a lot of people, but a lot of people who don't want to work for a living rather want to gamble for a living, then it's a good word. But I wanted to throw that in there so that people understand that capitalism at its original inception was very fundamental to the growth of this great nation. It has become an evil as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and see, that's kind of the unfortunate part, too, in a lot of ways, is that it was supposed to be, or at least in one sense was originally, the notion where you take your creative genius and your physical labor, and you with your fellow man basically mix those with the natural resources, the natural products of this absurdly abundant planet, and you create wealth. And that's basically it. There's nothing fictional about any of this. It's very tangible, and you know, it either is there or it's not, and what is there is quite fantastic if you're willing to upon the sweat of your brow and all of that. And you're right, it has become much more of a gambling casino and all that. And it's kind of unfortunate too, regarding the actual word itself. You know, I've heard of crony capitalism. You know, there's that, which is not really capitalism. So a little bit of the stuff there. Actually, a good one, and this will kind of play on one we covered already, state capitalism, too, which is not really capitalism either. It's something completely different. But, you know, here's the other problem, too, is that, you know, a lot of libertarians are known as, you know, free market advocates. But then when they talk about, you know, for example, when we talk about the free market, people then say, oh, you're for capitalism and for all this, you know, evil, you know, Wall Street stuff. And it's like, no. That's different. That's corporatism, which is the nicer word for fascism. That's corporatism. It's the, you know, rule by, for, of, by, and for the corporations, you know, and by, and the add-on to that is by virtue of government privilege. The only way corporations are able to get away with any of their crap is by virtue of the government. So ultimately, it always goes back to government at the end of the day.
There's a concept that goes along with this that I think is rather interesting, too. Those original projects in capitalism were trying to build an old saying, build a better mousetrap. They wanted a good product at a fair price. Henry Ford was probably most demonstrative of that. He wanted everybody that worked for him to be able to buy a Model T Ford or Model A, I forget which one. But he wanted a good product, but he wanted it affordable, a good product at a fair price. Now, mentality in this country, along with the shift to gambling rather than true capitalism, has gone to from a good product at a fair price, and we've gone along with it, to bottom line mentality. Now, how much money can I get regardless of the quality of the product? Planned obsolescence. They design things to not last too long because, hey, once they sell one to everybody, then there's no more market. Well, if they were smaller, they could continue to sell to everybody, but they want to get bigger and bigger. So they've got to start designing the product to last 3 to 1 year so that you have to replace it. So we've gone to this obsession with money. Capitalism has converted to an obsession for quick profit, I guess you could call it profit. They do for tax purposes. a quick profit, regardless of the consequences. And our production has gone the same way. Well, maybe not in this country, but the stuff we buy from China, boy, that stuff doesn't last very long at all. In fact, a lot of things, I think they put a little chip in there that says, okay, it was purchased in this state, so it's going to fall apart once that one-year warranty is up. Give it 5 extra days. What the heck? The whole idea is to bring money in, regardless of the quality of the product. In fact, the quality of the product has become inconsequential. How many dollars can I get for it?
Yeah, and the worst part, too, is that, I mean, let's take this another step further. You know, you mentioned about the obsession with money, and it's like, well, what's the currency here? Are we talking about, like...
Well, let's not get into Federal Reserve. That is not a part of this program.
But, yeah, suffice it to say, there are multiple levels to how how capitalism, the concept of it, has definitely been torn apart. And that's why, unfortunately, a lot of guys who want the true, real, laissez-faire free markets won't even use the word capitalism. They'll use other words. They'll talk about free markets. I've heard market anarchy. I've heard all sorts of other terms to try and describe actual capitalism without using the word capitalism, because unfortunately you have too many of these kind of quasi-socialist hippie types, like the Occupy Wall Street people, for example, is a most recent event. Where they say, oh, you know, all this, you know, Wall Street's bad with all the corporatism, which is really what it was about, and it's all because of capitalism, so we need to abolish capitalism and everything will be fine. I'm like, wow, you sound like a commie. Oh, but wait a minute, that's right. The Wall Street Revolution got communism started, but can't talk about history. But again, capitalism, it's just gone, it's devoid of meaning, much like the other words we've mentioned earlier tonight.
Okay, we've got another word there.
Yes. And this will probably ruffle some feathers, but it has to be mentioned. militia. Webster's 1828 defines militia as the primary sense of fighting is to survive, struggle, drive, or to strike, to beat. It is the body of soldiers in a state enrolled for discipline, but not engaged in actual service except in emergencies, as distinguished from regular troops whose sole occupation is war or military service. The militia of a country are the able-bodied men organized into companies, regiments, and brigades with officers of all grades and required by law to stay to attend military exercises on certain days only, but at other times left to pursue their usual occupations.
Yeah, we can even go a little further. And, you know, if we read the Constitution, it never talks about a United States militia. It talks about the state militia. And the state militia, interestingly, were never a state militia. They were county or plantation or town militias that were together collectively. Hate using that word in front of you all, but collectively they comprised, say, the militia of South Carolina. But there was no militia of South Carolina. There were the separate and unique entities from the counties, towns, and plantations. But somewhere in the early 1900s, the United States government, in contradiction to the Constitution, because there is no reference to the United States militia, enacted 10 U.S. Code 3, Section 311. So paragraph A, the militia of the United States consists of all able-bodied males at least 17 years of age and except as provided in Section 313 of Title 32, under 45 years of age, who are or who have made a declaration of intention to become citizens of the United States, and of female citizens of the United States who are members of the National Guard. Now, that female citizens was added later. The original one, though, creating the United States militia, dates back to the early 1900s. And then it goes, the classes of militia are the organized militia, which consists of the National Guard and the Naval Militia, and the unorganized militia, which consists of the members of the militia who are not members of the National Guard or Naval Militia. So the United States back then incorporated everybody in the country, or at least citizens of the United States, and we're not going to talk about citizenship, so we'll just be general in the discussion. Which is rather interesting because I got thinking about this. And what happens if you don't call up when they call for the militia? You're a deserter, right?
Yes.
So the government, back in the early 1900s, set up a system whereby they could arrest you for not answering the call up. If you answered the call up and disobeyed orders, they could put you in the brig. They actually made you slaves to the federal government based on a constitution that left the right of militias to reside with the state. I thought it was rather interesting. But let's look at militia, too. What is the militia? Well, more than anything, and you read the definition from Webster's 1828, more than anything, it is there for as an emergency to afford military protection during emergencies. Let's describe it differently and see if the description fits. How about collective self-defense? Does that seem appropriate to reduce it down to simple terms?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's collective self-defense. There's that communist word again. Damn it. however, the history of militia goes back in English heritage, and remember, we evolved from that, contrary to the belief of some people. And the militia was always, and in fact, most states do recognize either in their constitution and or their codes that the militia shall always be subordinate to the civil authority. Always be subordinate to the civil authority. That means the militia was not a gang of warlords or thugs. The whole concept of posse comitatus was based on that. Since you're in the militia, if the sheriff needs you to arrest a bad guy, you're on call. You're part of the militia. You're part of the power or the authority of the county to be called forward to suit that purpose. And the sheriff is the civil authority that calls you forward. We look back through our history. We look back through English history, and there was always a civil authority. There were a few times in our history where that civil authority was not the governor, not the king, not some other figurehead. Rather, it was the Committee of Safety, which is a civil authority. That was true in the time of Cromwell. And it was true in the time of our revolution that the obedience went from the governor, the civil obedience, went from the governor to the committees of safety in this country. So there has to be that obedience to civil authority. And, well, I've said it, and I'm going to say it again. I might be wrong now because I've been talking about this for a couple of years, and I haven't stayed in touch with some people that seem to understand it. But to the best of my knowledge, there is not a true militia in this country today. Because they have verbicided the word to justify them proclaiming themselves to be general of the army, and all these people have to work for them without pay.
Oh, wow.
Now, the interesting thing about the militia is they always received pay in colonial times. They received compensation in Cromwell's times. Some of them in Cromwell's time, the Committee of Safety made sure that food was produced and the families were cared for when these people went off to serve the militia. And basically, we had the same thing happening in this country, that nobody starved to death because their husband went off in militia. He might not have as much, he might not have surplus to sell, because his obligation as a citizen of that community was to that community and to do what was necessary. He had to give up to retain the protection of the community, collective self-defense. So we don't have any militias in this country today. I'm going to say that right now. If I'm wrong, please, somebody tell me that you've got one. Now, here's a case where the patriot community has verbicided a word to satisfy their own egotistical desire for control. I hate to put it that way. And it's probably not true in all cases. I'm sure that some of the militia out there, the professed militia, are sincere. But a lot of them seem to be, there's a guy in one state, and I'm not going to mention the state of Ohio, that thinks that everybody in the state has to come under his authority. Oh, I mentioned the state, son of a gun. The presumption of his authority is rather interesting, because the committee, the civil authority, commissions the officers. Now, there were elections of certain officers, squad, platoon, company even. But I can't find an instance in history where even a battalion elected their officer. The battalion officers were all commissioned based on politics quite often, but sometimes performance. The majors were commissioned by the Committee of Safety at their discretion. Lower levels were voted on, but then they received their commission from the civil authority. Now, I've talked to a number of professed militia officers, and I've asked some of them, where's your commission? What commission? I don't need a commission. So, we have no militia. The obedience to civil authority is non-existent. Now, why do I bring this up? This is a rather touchy subject to a lot of people. Let's get it right. If we want to restore this country, we have to recognize that there is a structure that was in place 230 years ago that achieved what we can't achieve now because everybody's backbiting and infighting. If you're going to call yourself militia, talk to the governor of the state, or help form a local committee of safety so that you have some civil authority to authorize your existence. And at that point, you will become a militia as defined by the Constitution and the Second Amendment and various other parts of the Constitution, Articles 1 and 2 specifically. So we're as guilty as Verbside is the government, but only in this one instance that I think of.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, what that, and not only that, but I thought that you know, the Constitution was supposed to you know, we're supposed to have a Republican form of government, and I know that a key aspect of Republicanism is, I think you mentioned this earlier, the you know, the subordination of the military to the civil power. And yeah, that's something I've kind of noticed that's kind of haunted my conscience over the years.
Well, that's just not in Republicanism. That goes back, I'm sorry, I said Cromwell's time, but actually the militia and subordination of civil authority goes back to the Magna Carta. You'll find that addressed in the Magna Carta in, what was it, 1218 or something like that, a long time ago.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, well, in any case, it's just something of concern to me because, you know, the different guys who say, you know, I'm a militia member. One of the things I have always asked any guys I come across, even, you know, guys locally here in Texas, you know, I go to a meeting with or something, and I ask them, like, who's your CO? And they tell me, I'm like, okay, and, you know, so what's the chain of command here? And like, okay, and then I eventually get to the question of, you know, who's your civil authority? Well, we don't have one. I'm like, well, what are you talking about? And then obviously it kind of goes downhill from there. You know, Gary, it's almost as if several of the well-intentioned, I don't mean the power-hungry type guys, but I mean the well-intentioned guys who mean well, but don't know what they're doing. It's almost as if what they do manage to do is kind of putting together, I guess you could say, a quasi-security team, but kind of screwing that up a little bit because they publicly advertise for it.
Well, I think maybe gang is more appropriate.
Okay.
Except they train, and I don't know that gangs train. I don't know any gang members, but I assume that gangs don't train. They might, you know, go out and kill somebody or something just to see if you can do it, but or something like that, where the ones that call themselves militia are gangs where they actually train. They get together and train, and yeah, I think we're all aware of that. Mm-hmm. For some reason, they think that they're going to be fighting in the woods if we have to restore the Constitution, which I think is a mistake. To me, camo is back to Jack Purcell tennis shoes, blue Levi's, and a white T-shirt. That's camouflage. Clothing is actually quite dangerous. Right now.
Yes, it is. It points a target. I mean, you might as well just spray paint, you know, a target on the back of your head and say, you know, basically say, hey, you know, hey, enemy rebel government, please shoot me. It's really that bad. And also considering one other thing too, last time I remember, it's something like 70 or 80% of the country is like urbanized. So that what it kind of reveals, what you're kind of suggesting really reveals a gross misunderstanding of the field of battle. I mean, most of the population is urbanized. That means that your battlefield is going to be a combination of inner cities and suburbs, not out in the back 40 with a creek and a bunch of trees.
Right.
And so I think that kind of, so yeah, I mean, even on the more military angle side of it, they're kind of screwing up there too with their FTXs or whatever it is that they do, and they run around and play paintball, which I kind of found a lot of the snobbishness is not good either. Like, oh, what did you do? Like, well, I went out and trained. I'm like, how did you train? Oh, we played paintball on Saturday. No, literally. I've talked to several guys, private conversations, and that's literally what at least four different units have told me, pretty much word for word. I just, like, dude, man, if I want to go play paintball, but it's a game. You know, a paintball marker doesn't operate like an actual firearm, the recoil, the sound, the aiming, all the, you know, 20,000 different details that all go into that. It's completely different. It's not real training.
Now, to give a little bit of insight into the history of militia, too, on May 2nd, 1792, the Militia Act of 1792, under the Constitution, was passed. Section 1, being enacted by the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that whenever the United States shall be invaded or be in imminent danger of invasion from any foreign nation or Indian tribe, it shall be lawful for the President of the United States to call forth such number of the militia of the state or states most convenient to the place of danger or scene of action as he may judge necessary to repel such invasion and to issue his orders for that purpose to such officer or officers of the militia as he shall think proper, and in case of insurrection in any state against the government thereof, it shall be lawful for the President of the United States on application of the legislature of said state or of the executive, when the legislature cannot be convened, to call for such number of the militia of any other state or states as may be applied for, as he may judge to be sufficient to suppress such insurrection. Now, interestingly, he said it twice, the militia of the state or states. He didn't say the state militia. He said the militia of. Militia is a plural and singular. It's one of those funny words. There's no militia is not a word. The militia of the state. That means the militia within that state. It doesn't mean the state militia, or they would have said the state militia. So what they're talking about is these local entities, because it is collective self-defense. Then it goes on, and be it further enacted that whenever the laws of the United States shall be opposed or the execution thereof obstructed in any state by combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Oh, wait, there wasn't an FBI then? Or by the powers vested in the marshals by this act, the same being notified to the President of the United States by an associate justice or the district judge, it shall be lawful for the President of the United States to call forth the militia of such state to suppress such combinations to cause laws to be duly executed. And if the militia of a state, well, there was no FBI back then. Can you imagine that? U.S. Yep. Marshals, the only ones they mentioned, law enforcement, the U.S. Marshals in 1792. And if the militia of a state, where such combination may happen, shall refuse or be insufficient to suppress the same, it shall be lawful for the president of the, if the legislature of the United States shall not be in session, to call forth and employ such number of the militia of any other state or states most convenient thereto. Interesting. Well, there's the civil authority, and that was the presumption by the Constitution that the president, being the civil obedience in certain circumstances, and the circumstances were named in both sections, can call forth the militia. Within the state, it's the governor. Within the county, it's whoever the civil authority in the county is, which nowadays is generally a board or a commission or something like that. But the subordination of civil authority and the ability to call up exists. Now, if you've got a militia that's just running around shooting paintball in the wood, I hope it's water soluble so it washes off the trees after a while, but who can call them up? Or do they call themselves up? Now, when they call themselves up, they become a gang.
Yeah, yeah. So I think in terms of the verbicide, how the word militia has been verbicided, I think what you are describing is essentially what was a type of military unit that was kind of a standing unit that would be called up in a time of emergency that followed the orders of a civil authority, whether it be a governor or a committee of safety or something along those lines. Transitioning from something like that, which is the original concept, the actual meaning of the word, to this weird Twilight Zone concept of it. It is. No, I'm serious. It is this freaking Twilight Zone.
You're right. I'm laughing because this is appropriate.
To this Twilight Zone verbicided concept of the word militia, now basically meaning a arbitrary gang of I'm usually middle-aged, but yeah, yes, and that's what it's
well, actually, they're not thugs unless they attempt to assert their force upon somebody, so they're not really thugs, but they are a gang.
Okay, well, in any case, though, to try to kind of put this on a positive note, considering what a lot of our audience is, what would be a better route for those guys who still want to have that more, who want to specialize in that more of that kind of like military preparedness type thing? I mean, what would be another route for them to go? Should they set up a committee of safety or a security team, or what would you suggest instead?
Well, you know, there's no reason they can't. You know, if the right of collective self-defense exists within a community, if five or six of us from the community want to set up a collective self-defense group, or say what I refer to as a security team, and I think in Behind Enemy Lines we did that, didn't we?
That was an OPF radio episode, but yes, folks could refer to that older episode called, you know, security teams, we've already described how that works.
The whole concept of militia doesn't preclude that, because in that case, you're looking at protecting yourself from the Indians if you're invaded by Indians. So you can't say, well, since we don't have a community and a committee of safety and a governor and all this to call us forth, that we have no right to protect ourselves. No, the concept of protection, collective self-defense, and the whole idea of militia cannot be exclusive of a group of people who, for whatever reason, feel that they can work together in a collective self-defense. I don't see how it can... I don't see it prohibited anywhere.
Right.
But the difference is they're not a militia because they've removed themselves from the civil authority responsibility, but their collective self-defense, which is a right. The right to keep and bear arms is based on the right to protect my property and my life. What right means anything if I'm dead?
Yeah.
So the fundamental right, look at the numbering of in the Bill of Rights, too. The first one is the right to freedom of speech and press. That's communication, interacting with other people, sharing ideas without suppression of thought via suppression of speech. The second one is the right to keep and bear arms, and that is to protect the life, because without those two, without my ability to talk with you and decide that we're going to protect ourselves from Indians or any foreign invasion or anything, until the militia can be called together, we have to wait on the militia. That's like waiting for the cop when your daughter's being raped.
Yeah, and it says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It didn't say the right of the militia. It said right of the people.
Right. So to me, a security team, as long as his only purpose is that collective self-defense in a very compact manner, the small, relatively small group of people, is not excluded by any concept of militia.
Right.
It does mean that they are part of the larger militia should that be called up, because that obligation extends to an age group within a geographic area. So they're members of the militia, but that doesn't preclude them from acting as a security team for collective self-defense.
Right, and those of us who are already either in a state of nature or are moving toward a state of nature along the other not-so-thin line that you've written about kind of already understand about what, you know, collective self-defense is, at least in some regards. So it doesn't require... it doesn't really require a civil authority, and then with that you set up a militia and all that. It's a state of nature. It's just, you know, we're out in the we might as well be out on the frontier, and we're dealing with the elements as best as we can, and part of that means we have to, you know, be able to use force judiciously in a morally acceptable way. It's just a fact of life.
The militia is called up to go after an obvious problem, maybe the next county. There's a book, The Minutemen, by John Galvin. Phenomenal book, because he goes into greater depth than anybody that I've seen as far as what happened around the date of Lexington and Concord. And as far as the civil authority, one of the militia had to send a rider, and it took 7 hours for them to send the rider out, get permission from the proper person in the Committee of Safety to allow them to leave the county. So they missed the battle. They ended up at, you know, Bunker Hill or Charleston later, But that 7 hours, they missed shooting at the Redcoats because they could not leave their county without the express consent of the civil authority within their county, which is kind of interesting, and it gets to the same point. They could have protected themselves if their county were invaded. They could have protected themselves against Indians that came after them or British that came after them in their own homes or their own little cluster of homes. So that right is inherent in this, but they can't leave. The call-up and especially leaving the geographic area are objects of authority entrusted to the civil body, whether it be the president calling them from the most convenient states or the county next door calling them. So if we look at that whole structure, the concept of a security team for collective self-defense cannot be excluded. But the obligation, there's a Texas Militia Association or something like that is calling for a meetup in Arizona. And, you know, that just defies logic. Why is Texas Militia calling for a meetup in Arizona?
Yeah,
did Arizona invite them?
Huh. Yeah, I wonder if they ever heard of the notion of jurisdiction.
No, because they're gangs, and gangs don't have to restrict themselves to any geographic boundaries, even though history of the militia has those limitations upon it. You have no right to leave. And this goes back into the 90s. There was a lady up in one of the Midwestern states that was being evicted from her house. Now, she didn't ask for the militia to come, but they were coming from all these states around there. Militia units were coming, and they were going to protect her. She didn't want protection, but they were going to protect her anyway. That's pretty presumptive.
Yeah, quite. Yeah, have you ever heard the notion of trespass?
Well, or criminal activity.
Well, I'm trying to give a little bit of benefit of the doubt, but sure.
Most states, too, have a law against training paramilitary. Mm. Well, militia's not paramilitary. Collective self-defense in the form of security teams, not paramilitary. But paramilitary is what these guys are when they think on their own they can go into another county, another state, and they're opening themselves up to prosecution under laws that are legitimate based on the concept of militia by so doing.
Well, maybe if they learn how to take care of their own backyard, a lot of that stuff could be alleviated. But yeah, Gary, as we start to close out for tonight, I guess this is probably the...
Well, let me get one more point here. Section 4 of the Militia Act 1792, that the militia employed in the service of the United States shall receive the same pay and allowances as the troops of the United States who may be in service at the same time. Oh, damn, they get paid. Now, security team, you don't expect payment, but militia, some got paid to train, some didn't get paid to train. But whenever they were called up, they got paid every day that they were on call up. And that, now, when you got one of these militias we've got, where's the pay coming from?
There isn't any.
Oh, I guess I won't join one then. I want to get paid.
Well, you know, if they want to try and take over all of whatever that state was you mentioned earlier, then yeah, I hope they do get paid, right? In any case, as we start to close out for tonight, I guess this is probably the $1 million question as opposed to the $64,000 question from earlier, although both are very important. Gary, can verbicide change the interpretation of a law?
Definitely. It can. It allows laws to be enacted that should not be enacted under the Constitution. And I go to the Civil Rights Act and the Equal Rights Amendments. They don't have any authority in the Constitution. If I outlaw an act that means one thing and then I change the meaning of that, I broaden the act to include people that wouldn't. Law is intent. You know, I can't think of a good example offhand, but if I broaden the interpretation of what this word is, then I have broadened the applicability of the law beyond the intent when the law was enacted. So yes, so it works two ways. One, by changing the definition of what something means and broadening the scope of the law. And the other one is using a word misconstrued, and I'll use welfare for an example, misconstrued to provide the government the means to give other people my money. So from both directions, yes, verbicide can be used to change the interpretation of a law or the authority of law. When you say interpretation of a law, that would be, say, a statute written down, but then the Constitution is law too, and it sets down what the authority is. And when they start providing the welfare rather than promoting the general welfare by verbicide, they have granted themselves an authority that otherwise does not exist in the Constitution.
Well, and because all those statutes in the legal code are all, you know, they're all written down, they're all codified, it does, I guess it would matter very much what they actually mean by certain words. Mm-hmm. And wasn't, and correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it Richard MacDonald who said that nobody ever looks up the meanings of the words that the government uses?
He may have. You mean state citizen Richard MacDonald?
Yes.
Well, I spent 2 weeks with Richard back in 1992, and I learned a hell of a lot from him. I don't recall that particular phrase, but then when I was there, I was going through, the guy's got a phenomenal library, and I was going through book after book after book trying to learn what I could. Now, I've continued my education and acquisition of books well beyond what he did. He stuck strictly to legal things. I've looked at historical as well, but Richard is the preeminent state citizen in this country. Nobody holds a candle to Richard MacDonald as far as state citizenship.
But yeah, in terms of the meanings of the words that they use, I guess the penultimate point here is that if verbicide is so present in, you know, the political discourse as well as just a normal, you know, sociocultural type of way, then wouldn't it also make sense that there be verbicide in the actual legal statutes, which they would actually probably prosecute people under?
Well, I don't know where the hinge point is in this, but I'm going to run one by you that seems to fit that description. The 18th Amendment, prohibition of alcohol. It took a constitutional amendment to outlaw a drug called alcohol. Of course, everybody turned their back, and eventually they would go ahead and get convictions, so they undid the law. But they presumed then the authority to regulate or control drugs. So now, without the benefit of an amendment, and I'm not sure, like I say, I don't know the hinge point. I don't know quite how they did that. They must have enacted some laws during Prohibition that presumed an authority based upon that amendment, and then the amendment was dissolved. They kept the laws on the books, and now they have the authority to outlaw other drugs, not by constitutional amendment. The drugs that were commonly used. I understand that back then, during alcohol prohibition, you could go down to the corner drugstore without a prescription from a doctor and buy marijuana, cannabis sativa, or cocaine, or morphine. I forgot what they called it now. There was a liquid morphine that was laudanum. Laudanum was liquid morphine. It was a painkiller. And a lot of people made a habit of killing pain, whether they had any or not. But if we're a free country, I would presume, and since the Constitution says we're supposed to be relatively free, the general welfare provision as promoting the general welfare, and such, and an old saying from when I was young, each man has a right to his own poison, the government has no right to intrude upon that. Somehow they achieved the right, and I would say that I haven't studied the history, as I said, but I would assume that there's a degree of verbicide in the transition to giving a legislative authority where only the amendment authority existed prior to that.
Wow. Okay. Well, Gary, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight and really kind of describing for us really what verbicide is. Definitely appreciate it.
Okay, well, as usual, enjoyed doing it, and hope that people benefit, at least some people benefit by what we've discussed tonight.
All right, good deal. All right, everyone, that's going to conclude this episode of OPF Radio. Please join us for future podcasts available on our website located at www.outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. Again, that's outpost-of-freedom.com/radio.
All lowercase,
thank you. Also, feel free to refer to our previous episodes of OPF Radio for topics such as how to role-play police interrogations, how to stop banking, how to form your own security teams, and probably most importantly, how to take the initiative. Good night and good luck.